Hey, what up, everybody, and welcome to episode 6 of A Theology of Hustle, where we talk about work, ministry, and the people who make an art out of bringing them together. Today, we are talking to Matt. He is a professional counselor and a marriage and family therapist, and this episode's just a lot of fun. We get into some of the backgrounds of mental health and some of just what makes Matt tick and what has led him to the profession he's in. We talk about some about the system of mental health, and he's just a really engaging guy, and I think you're going to really like this interview. So be sure to check it out. If you don't mind, get out there and share it on social media. Be sure and go into your app or whatever and like and review all that good stuff. And be sure and just let me know what you think. I love hearing from you. So enjoy. All right. Hey, Matt, how you doing?
Doing all right.
Good,
how are you?
Good. Yeah, doing good. Thanks for opening your office to this interview. And it's beautiful, by the way. I love it.
Well, thanks.
So why don't we just get started with your story? Why don't you just give us a little sort of background on who you are, what you do,
sure.
All that stuff.
Sure. Yeah. Well, very proud of my Philadelphia roots. Technically grew up in New Jersey, but about really a Philadelphia suburb, just about 7 minutes outside of downtown Center City, Philly.
Yeah, so we should probably stop right here and just say one of the biggest beefs between Matt and I is he is an Eagles fan and I am a Cowboys fan, and it was a rough year for me. It was a good year for me though.
you did have a good year.
So that, yeah. But he like brainwashes my kids at church, you know, trying to get them to be Eagles.
We can get
fans.
Them to, you know, enjoy the Eagle Green.
Right, yes.
You're
very good at it.
Yes. So yeah, grew up there for the first decade of my life. And then my dad was actually moved out to Illinois when I was 10. So most of my family, actually all of my family, both my mom and dad come from big families, all lived kind of in the same, basically the same neighborhood out in New Jersey. So this was a big deal to be moved out of kind of the safety nest of family. We were the first ones in the family to move out of there. Had lots of aunts and uncles and cousins. So pretty monumental event in the life of what felt like kind of small blue-collar town for us. Tight-knit family, Christian family, grew up in the church, several pastors in the family. And just overall would have said very close family. So that move at that point was a big deal, but brought us out to the Chicagoland area. And at that point kind of started fresh, didn't know anybody. But spent then kind of middle school years, high school years, out in this area, kind of a culture shock to a certain degree, for people who have been to the East Coast, Philadelphia area and then could compare it to kind of Midwest area. It's a pretty big difference in the way people live, people operate. Attitudes are quite a bit different. Was very struck by how kind people seem to be in the Midwest compared to, people out on the East Coast.
Is that true?
I think it's very, here's the way I put it. People out in New Jersey have huge hearts, but it's going to take some time to break through.
Oh, okay.
You know, like the first time I had someone stop for me in a parking lot, like out in Illinois, I was thinking like, wow, that is the nicest person I've ever met.
Wow.
Cause like cars don't stop for you where I'm from. Well, like they yell at you and keep going and you better stay out of the way.
It's crazy because coming from Texas, we came to Illinois and we're like, man, these people are so crazy. Like they're so rude. Because in Texas, I mean, like you don't walk down the street without like waving at each other and, you know, smiling. I mean,
no.
I don't think I'd survive.
No, you don't want to make eye contact too long around there or, you know. But if you're not being yelled at, then that's a problem too. You know, your own family should be yelling at you as much as a perfect stranger on the street.
Okay, that makes sense.
But a little bit of a shock for us. But that was ultimately ended up probably opening up some pretty big doors just in terms of as I look at life. Blessing in disguise in a way that really just a move like that probably expanded the world I live in just by being able to meet different people and Ended up living in an area then where people were from a lot of different places. Well, where I was from in New Jersey, I mean, most people were pretty multi-generations, had been pretty much in the same neighborhoods in the same places. So it was the first time that I really thought, wow, there's things outside of Pennsylvania, New Jersey, New York area, and kind of got a bigger picture. So that ultimately had a great, good high school experience out here and was ultimately a good trajectory to let me then kind of stretch my own wings and get out of town and went to college down in Wilmore, Kentucky, right, which is a tiny little town outside of Lexington, Kentucky. But went there with kind of big dreams of being one thing. I actually went there with the thought that I was going to be a communications major. I thought I was going to be like on TV, on ESPN, doing some sort of broadcasting, something like that.
Well, you have a wonderful voice. I mean, we just talked about how you don't like your voice, but it's very soothing. I could listen to it all day.
I had gotten some compliments later in high school when I had given some speeches, and it kind of just like threw me into this concept of like, okay, well, I'll do some sort of communications work without even knowing what that really was. Ended up down there. It took me all of a semester to like drop that major because it just was not, I didn't enjoy any of the technical aspects of it or anything like that. But made the best of it. Ended up getting a degree in psychology, which I really enjoyed and ultimately brought me back in the Chicagoland, Wheaton area, went to Wheaton College for grad school. So that's ultimately how I wound up back here.
Okay.
And up in a couple different places.
Yeah, nice. Nice. Yeah. Okay, so what is it you do then now?
So currently I work as a licensed professional counselor, own my own practice, Tiller Counseling, and spend most of my days doing individual therapy, couples therapy, in the mental health field. Just, I like to say I'm helping people who are stuck people, stuck in all sorts of ways and trying to get them unstuck.
Yeah. Sounds like a noble pursuit, right?
Some days it feels more noble than others when good things are happening.
Yeah. Okay. So there's a lot of different ways that I feel like we could go with this. I guess, let's start off by just, I feel like in the evangelical church, there might be some sort of, and you can correct me if I'm wrong here, but there might be some sort of stigma even around what you do, just, that counseling isn't necessary for the Christian that could just needs to trust God more, or, you know, any sort of these things that we say, and may not even say out loud, but is in the background of how we think. So how do you sort of view what you do in light of sort of your Christian foundations and that sort of thing?
Yeah, it's kind of a shame because, you know, there is something that's true, right? And that is that Jesus Christ is sufficient. Jesus Christ is enough. He can work miracles. And so certainly any sickness problem that ails us, I have no problem with a church or a Christian's assertion that Jesus could solve that in a second. Where it becomes problematic, right, is that at times we've extended that into the mental health world, I think because maybe it's less tangible, right? We can't put our hands on it like we could a broken bone or something else. And where we're maybe much less comfortable, even as Christians, allowing someone to suffer with a broken bone, right? We'd very quickly take them to the emergency room or to a doctor to get that fixed because we can see it. We're a little bit more hesitant maybe with the mental, emotional side of things because we can't quite put a finger on how comfortable we are with calling it an illness, how comfortable we are with calling it just a problem or an issue or something that somebody should get over. So I think the stigma is weakening, but I think that one of the major ways that that's being done and how I choose to think about it is that if people can recognize that the fall is real, right? At a certain point, you know, God created humanity in a in the form that he intended, in a perfect form. And then, and when sin entered the world and the fall happened, that was distorted. And we can see it in the physical nature around us. We can see it in sickness and pain that occurs in people's physical form. And I think it'd be real oversight to say that fall hasn't also impacted the way people think, people behave, the way people are in relationships, the way they feel, even the way that the chemicals are affected in their brain. And so just in the same way that that we can feel free to give people advice on how to get healthier physically, or how to, there's all sorts of things we can give advice on, that why would we not also kind of reach into the thing, other things that we know to be true about the way people think and the way people feel? And so I think when there's a stigma in place, there's a misconception that somehow psychology is in opposition to our faith. And maybe there have been times, some of that maybe has been warranted. There have been figures in the world of psychology in the past who have certainly been anti-religion, anti-faith, anti-God. And so that hasn't given a good reputation. But I assume there have been plenty of brain surgeons and heart surgeons who have been that way as well. So just like many of these other things, I feel that it's my job to utilize the truths that we can read explicitly in Scripture, but then also kind of expand those truths to what we observe in human nature, the way we think, the way we act, and helping move people closer to hopefully how God intended it to be, to a healthier version of themselves. Anything that's moving people to a healthier version of themselves, I believe, is moving them closer to God. That's a big overarching thing for me.
That's good.
If it's not moving them closer to God, I can't claim that they're getting healthier. That to me doesn't compute. So if I'm helping them get healthier, I'm moving them closer to God.
Okay. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Well said. I guess that probably just leads us into this next question, though, because your practice, which my wife is a part of, right, is not a biblical counseling practice, even though you're both Christians. And
intentionally so.
Okay, so can you sort of talk through maybe some of that? And let me start with this. How many people would you say that you have seen or see regularly that are professing Christians?
I would say at any given moment, 80% of my clients are not Christians.
Okay.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about how what that looks like and how you do counseling and why not, this sort of biblical style of counseling.
Right. I think I pull together a couple foundational ideas, right? And this can get tricky in some places, but is simpler than you might think in others. If I believe that there is I believe there are ways to think, ways to feel, ways to relate to others that are healthiest, that are both supported scripturally, and then we also see agreement in the world of psychology. And so when it comes to helping people who aren't Christians, there's not like one set of rules for people who aren't Christians, one set of things who are good for non-Christians, and one set of things that are good for Christians. So slightly what you might see different is simply that when I'm working with someone who's professing to be a Christian or having that faith, we can more explicitly cite the foundational pieces that are in the Bible, right? We can more specifically cite things that they believe to be true from a faith perspective to also kind of support these other pieces that we're doing. For clients who don't share that same faith background, we're not suddenly going a different direction. The same principles are true. The same things that are healthy are true. But that there's this other piece where we're respecting another person's how do I put this? If another person comes in here of a different faith or of no faith or of no specific religion that they're tied to, we still believe that the principles of getting them healthier, the principles of moving them to better relationships, better ways of thinking still apply. We don't need to, for the sake of helping them move to that direction, we don't need to confront the spiritual element directly. So that's how I kind of relegate it in my mind. Now, if there's ever a time where there's something that they're wanting to accomplish that's directly in opposition to truths that are both kind of spiritually grounded and also psychologically grounded, because I don't see much of a difference there, then the problem becomes bigger, right? It becomes, I don't know if I can do my job as a clinician to help you move in a direction that I don't think is actually healthy or good for you. Right. So yeah. it goes beyond just someone's beliefs at that point.
Yeah. Okay. That makes sense.
Yeah.
Okay. So, how then would you see sort of, in a normal counseling, you know, with just anybody, mm-hmm. how do you feel like the spirit, works with you or in you in order to, you know, facilitate counseling? Or have you sort of processed some of that stuff? Or
it's a good question. I think there's some people in some instances where that I'm more aware of that influence than with others. I know that I go into the work that I do in this helping profession believing that I am joining a work that is already in process, right? There is already a work happening in a person's life, the hands of God through the Holy Spirit. And I don't know at what place I'm joining in that work, but I know that I'm joining in a work with whoever comes into my office. And my job is to continue to move them along, move them forward, move them in a direction that's already been set up more or less, a direction towards healthiness. And so I'm joining the Holy Spirit in that. Sometimes I'm acutely aware of God working in those moments. I'm acutely aware of the Holy Spirit's presence because there are things happening that are beyond my explanation or insights and leadings and just things I even can observe happening in people's lives that I go, you know, I don't have much other explanation than there's other things at work here. But there are times when I'm in the room with someone and honestly, I'm relying quite a bit on something happening beyond what I'm completely aware. I mean, there, you know, semantics can sometimes get in the way of this because there's things that, you know, we're comfortable referring to as different levels of listening to someone or creating a space for someone to feel comfortable or facilitating something. And I think there's times where, because of what I believe, my practice of that is sometimes trying to create space for the Holy Spirit to work, trying to allow there to be room in the conversation for things to happen, you know, to kind of be responsive to a leading or a direction that I'm not really sure about. And I have freedom to do that because I'm allowed to take some chances like that. But I think I'm probably way more aware of that than even the people that I'm working with.
Interesting. That's interesting. This may be getting like too in depth and into the weeds of your story, I guess, mm-hmm. but is there some background that sort of led you to do this work? I mean, what do you feel like was the journey to from communications guy to a degree in psychology,
right.
You know?
Right. Yeah. You know, the communications thing was probably, a bit of an anomaly in a way. I mean, I think it was out of that seems more out of line. And I think was in a response to a skill that was recognized in me or a tool that was recognized in me that I was led to. But I think it actually starts back further than that because I can watch, you know, I was a kid that was just intrigued by people. You know, there's some kids who are just, you know, they're intrigued by machines. They're intrigued by TV. I just found people fascinating. I was an observer as a kid and I had a massive family. And I had this just fascination with seeing how my family, aunts and uncles and grandparents, all kind of in this muddled, loving mess of individuals, how they interacted with each other. So I was very much, I mean, people were so interesting to me, and watching how the impact that people have on one another, including the impact I could have on people, the impact others could have, sometimes very subtly, sometimes very obviously. And you know, for me, one of the things that still was kind of foundational to me heading in this direction, in my larger family growing up, large family, there were several, my grandparents were involved in the foster care system. Several of my aunts and uncles did some adoption out of some overseas and some from inner city of Philadelphia. And so observing not only my family and people, and then observing children my age coming in and out of my family, very much impacted by that process and what that meant in their lives, and watching that and knowing what that meant to me, watching what that meant to my family, really just kind of, I don't know if it was the observer in me, it was a bit of the wanting to figure things out, but I remember having a thought probably about age 10 before I left, going, there is some way that I want to be influential in people's lives to have the kind of impact that my family can have in the lives of other people, because I could watch these impacts take place. And I thought, there is something powerful there that I want to be able to do. And over the course of the next 10 years, I was trying out stuff. I thought I'd be an attorney. Oh, I could do that. That could impact people's lives. No, boring. Don't want to do that. I'll go into communications. That'll be fun. That's not going to do the trick. I thought about going into social work, and I love social workers. I love the work they do. I couldn't go down the social work track because I got too hung up in all the laws and legalities and things like that. And I ultimately ended up just being super interested in sociology and psychology, because it was just all about how people think, how people feel, how groups of people interact together, the impacts that people have on one another. And was always seeking, how can I influence for the better? How can I expand my own influence and the influence of others? Right. So it's always hearkening back to these early kind of growing up years when I thought, wow, there's this group of people who can have impact in a few people's lives or in many people's lives. And that's just going to continue to expand generation after generation after generation. And so I really felt like if I can impact even on small levels in people's lives, but in places where it's going to matter, right? Whether that be marriages, whether that be in their childhoods, whether that's before they start affecting other people, that even if it's just work one-to-one, there's going to be impact. There's going to be change that takes place across generations, and ultimately healing going to take place over generations. So that's always been the central theme for me since I was a little kid.
I mean, that's fairly mind-boggling.
It's crazy.
Since you were 10 years old, yeah, this was sort of nuts. A thought you had.
Yeah.
And I mean, Tiller, your counseling practice sort of has this background in your family, and family is like super important to you. Can you speak to sort of that, how that legacy of growing up around pastors and stuff, and all of that sort of like comes together?
It's Tiller ultimately is named after my grandfather. And family always represented loving people. I mean, I feel very fortunate that I actually, when I reference my family, I'm referencing it in a really positive way. And I understand there's a lot of people that don't reference family in a positive way, but I really do. We, not only did the family love each other very much, but because of the nature of where we grew up and how long everybody had been there, there was very much a community feel. The family knew a lot of people in the community, and very much both sets of grandparents really were known to be loving people in the community. My grandfather, who I named it after specifically, he and his wife, they were the ones who, I mean, I must have only been 5 years old. They had 6 kids of their own. They still had 2 at home, and they started bringing in, they became foster parents and started bringing in foster kids at whatever age they were at that point, you know, 60 years old. And honestly, it was my observation of, and that's probably the most poignant examples. I think other people did as well, but it was how people were quickly, kids, people were quickly assimilated into the family, were quickly loved by the family, right? You could picture a lot of families being close, but also being exclusive, right? Kind of a circle the wagons, but there was very much an attitude that was passed down from my grandparents of like, hey, once you're in, you're in. Like, you show up, we're pulling you in, you're part of this family, we love you, and we'll all get behind you on that. And to witness that from grandparents, and then that really kind of flowed through aunts and uncles, and ultimately down to cousins, and it's been huge.
Wow, that's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
That's a great legacy.
Yeah.
Okay, well, that's really cool. Your family, your background, I see that in you, which is cool to have that sort of described, you know, in your background. I think it's something that, a reason people are very attracted to you, not just in a, you know, you're an attractive guy kind of way.
Thanks,
but in
Gary.
Like, but in a like, no, this guy's really cool. He genuinely loves people. And I think that's very apparent. Just to switch gears though, a little bit, I think we were at setup this week at church and somebody was giving you crap about like, are you psychologizing me right now?
Right,
like,
right. Are you analyzing me or something?
And like that. So as a counselor, you constantly get that sort of background.
Right.
And I wonder how much truth do you think there really is to that? Or how much is that just like ridiculous?
I think there's a lot. I used to try to assure people that I wasn't, because it made me uncomfortable. Like, oh, you're probably assessing me right now. Oh, you're probably analyzing me right now. And I'd go out of my way to be like, no, I'm not. I'm just, you know, as though like, no, I'm just a normal person. As though it makes me weird. Now I've just started saying yes. Like, absolutely. Like, if you were anything else, like, if you were any other profession, right? If you were, I don't even know how, what do you, if I was an architect, right? Or I in construction, I built houses and I came to your house and you said, did you see what kind of house I live in? You'd say, yes, of course I did. If you said, what do you think of the construction? Have you noticed the construction of my house? You'd say, yes, of course I have. So when people now say, are you analyzing me? I'm like, yeah, unfortunately. I mean, whether you like it or not, I probably am. And I was probably doing it before I was a counselor as well. To be honest, I've just gotten better at it.
Yeah. Well, you know? I mean, I would question how good you were at your job if you could really turn right. it off. You know
right.
what I mean?
Because
it's
right.
just... what you do, right? It's a natural gifting that you... That
and it's observing do. People and it's... I mean, actually, you should better hope. If I'm in a conversation with you, it's probably a positive thing. If you want to say, are you analyzing me? It means I'm paying attention. I'm listening. I'm watching. I'm, you know, asking questions. Like, I hope so. Otherwise, I'm ignoring you.
Yeah, I'm engaged in this conversation, which means, you know, yeah. I guess we're all analyzing each other to some
yes.
extent. Some people are just better at it than others.
That's
right?
a good way to put it. I just yeah. might have some words for it. Yeah, exactly. That's true.
Right. Because I notice as counselors, my wife's a counselor, I notice counselors, they pick up on stuff that just flies over my head. I'm
yeah.
trying to analyze people,
yeah.
but nothing's computing. You know,
yeah.
there's like wires that don't connect.
We've
but
been
in your
taught
brain,
what to notice.
Right. Yeah.
You know,
well, and you've seen how many clients
right.
over the 15 years you've been in practice, right?
I mean, you see enough people, you start to pick up some patterns.
Right.
And
yeah.
And really, there's a lot of patterns amongst people. So it makes it easier to analyze.
Yeah, once you've seen it, you,
yeah.
you kind of... Okay, so to take that to the next level, though, I
yeah.
guess, as a counselor, you also are a family man, right?
Uh-huh.
You,
yeah.
You have 3 kids.
And, yeah.
How do you manage parenting along with having this counseling background? Because in mm. my household, we process everything, and we're constantly talking about emotions, but are there times where you found you've had to turn that off, or do you find that it sort of helps in all of these facets?
You know, I think I wish I could say that there's times where I've had to turn it off. I'm way more guilty of simply ignoring better judgment that I know and just kind of making huge, stupid mistakes at home and later going, oh, that goes against everything that I know is the right thing to do in that situation. So I don't know that I ever intentionally turn it off. in the sense of, you know, stop doing things that I know are good to do. But definitely, I mean, I have to know my role, right? And I guess that's the part that I have to switch out. I might know a lot of things that are good, right? Hopefully I can exhibit good listening at home. Hopefully I can exhibit good ways of interacting with my kids, good parenting skills, this kind of knowledge that I have of how to do it. But I should not be showing up at home as their counselor. So there is a certain translation of saying, it's kind of switching hats when I get home and going, I'm their dad. And in terms of my wife, I'm her husband. I'm not their therapist. I'm not their counselor. And so there's an interesting way that I have to translate that, because suddenly I have to do this from a non-detached role. I mean, for as warm as and cuddly as us counselors might appear in the room, right? We have a certain one-sidedness to that relationship. I sit in a room and it's for the other person. I don't have to manage what my relationship is going to look like with my client for the next 50 years, right? Hopefully not. That's not my goal, is to become a permanent figure in their life. When it comes to my kids, I do have to maintain my, you know, I am a person, an important person in their life who is involved in many more facets as their father than I would be as a counselor. And so if I become too much the counselor and distance myself from the impact they're having on me, then I think they're missing out. They're not getting all of their dad. And I think that's what I have to be a little careful of, to make sure I know which hat I'm wearing.
Yeah. No, that makes total sense. I had never even considered the one-wayness of that relationship, right? Because you get to self-disclose as much or little as you like to in a session, right?
Right.
But in your kids' relationship with your kids, if you're doing that, it's not a healthy relationship.
Right. They need to know they can have a huge impact on me, right? That is good for them to know that, right? That they can make me frustrated. They can make me feel happy. They can make me feel sad. They can do those things. Not in a kind of this, I want them to always feel like they can manipulate me, but this is a two-way street kind of a relationship. I don't want them to have control over that, but it's important for them to understand we're building a relationship as father and child, and it does matter what that relationship looks like.
Very well said. Yeah. I think that's super important.
Yeah.
Good. Okay, so this may be an odd question, and you can feel comfortable not to answer this on a professional level.
Okay.
But I feel like there might be a lot of people sort of out there listening or whatever that have thought about counseling, you know, and maybe see some stuff in their lives that they're not comfortable with. But counseling seems extreme, I guess, to them. You know, I've been in that position. You know, only recently have I gone back to, you know, get counseling from somebody. But what would you say to somebody sort of questioning these things? And when would you say would be a good time to get counseling?
Yeah. I mean, obviously I'm biased, so I probably think people should get counseling a lot. But I understand that it's daunting, especially for people who have never been. And so they have a certain version of counseling that they picture, either from, you know, TV or movies or people that they've heard about going to counseling who seem much more extreme than their case, right? That's often people wait to go to counseling until they feel like they're at the end of their rope and it's just desperate measures. And I think they also, for whatever reason, maybe there's a certain discomfort that they don't know what to expect when they get here. And really until you've been to counseling, you probably have a hard time knowing what to expect as well. So when, the beyond a counselor knowing a lot of information because they've studied human behavior and, you know, human psychology and they've collected kind of a lot of, information from other people they've worked with, one of the biggest assets of going to a counselor is the perspective that that counselor brings. The very fact that they're not in the problem. They're not stuck in the issue with you. And most people find that at some point, whatever they're struggling with or stuck in, the closest people to them have some sort of skin in the game, right? And so to talk about or to struggle with or reveal to or to lean on somebody in a certain way who's close to them, they realize they can't get a totally unadulterated perspective back. And that's what we hope to provide as a counselor. So there's not something really you know, especially a first session, there's not something magical that takes place. You don't show up and me say, here's the five steps to get better. You're really sharing with me your story in that first session. And I'm starting to hope to reveal to you some different ways to look at it, some different ways out, some different ways to see it, some different perspectives on it. I joke with people that it's pain-free. Obviously, counseling isn't pain-free because you're talking about things that can be very painful or intense, but there's not some required buy-in. Someone can come to see me for one session, and if they want to leave after that and go, well, that guy was a real weirdo, like, I'm never going back to counseling again, so be it. But you've spent an hour of your life, and you've seen if this process of unpacking it and getting this other perspective that's informed in ways that maybe the people in your life aren't, or has seen some things that maybe people in your life haven't, or it's just simply the safety of the four walls. I guess I understand that it's uncomfortable because you're literally going to talk to a perfect stranger about something that's probably very close to your heart and something you're either not that excited to talk about or you've been struggling with for a long time. So there's a very vulnerable feeling to that. But I think people wait too long, and most people probably wish that they had come sooner to counseling than waiting as long as they did. A simple answer, I think we all go through transitions in our life, and I kind of wish that it was just an expectation that at different transitions in life, you went to counseling. You know,
okay.
Graduate from high school, go to counseling, getting married, get counseling. Your kids leave the house, go to counseling. You have a child, go to counseling. Counseling doesn't have to be years and years and years of therapy, but you know, something significant happens in a person's life. It's not that, oh my goodness, they need counseling because they can't move forward without counseling, but I'm almost always talking to someone about something, some transition, some event that happened. And we're talking about it a year later or 2 years later or 10 years later, or 20 years later. So sometimes I wish people were more comfortable just saying, okay, I don't know what's going on, but there's a transition taking place. Let me go check in with my counselor.
Yeah, no, that's super interesting. And you may have hit on a point that I'm a little confused about or was confused about, in that, I mean, when you go through the whole insurance process for counseling and all that stuff, they want symptoms, right? Like these are the things, this is the reason I want to go to counseling. And in my mind, if I didn't have specific symptoms to go to counseling with, it felt like, what's the counseling for?
Right.
So in your mind, a transition in and of itself is enough of a symptom, for lack of a better word, or enough of a reason.
It's the sad influence that insurance has probably had on counseling, and we're certainly glad that insurance covers for a lot of people covers a good portion of their cost. But one of the sad pieces of that is that it has created this idea that the counseling world is somehow should follow the medical model. Meaning, here's a symptom. The point of this is to eliminate that symptom, is to provide the medicine, provide the treatment to eliminate that symptom. And I'm not opposed to that, but I think what it challenges is this concept that counseling is always a post-problem service, right? That you have to wait until you are really sick or really hurting or really messed up before coming to counseling, instead of viewing it as often a maintenance or pre-problem service to receive. Because, you know, for instance, I see far too many people who are coming to me a couple years into their marriage and they've done incredible damage in their marriage. Well, now they're coming to counseling because now we have a problem. But if at the transition into marriage, they had probably had a little bit of counseling, they wouldn't be coming to see me in this kind of the hurting sick state, and probably could have had way more of a benefit at that point. So it's a little bit of a detriment that insurance has had, that it's made people think of the medical model and go, unless there's clear, severe pain, that I shouldn't go work with a counselor. But that was never how, that's not really how this field came about. I mean, not ultimately this field came about before it was needing insurance to pay for it. I mean, we've always had counselors in the world, right? There's been, you can look to, there's always been sages and priests and people who handled the counseling of the community. I don't know this exactly, but you know, part of the paying for this profession was paying for the confidentiality and the place and the service of it when it started to leave the other common place in the community where it used to exist, where it doesn't quite exist as much anymore, or at least the need that probably has overwhelmed some of the community resources.
Yeah. Yeah. Well said. I mean, that makes a lot of sense, I guess. I mean, you go yearly for a health care checkup, right?
You take your car in to get tires rotated, oil changed. You know, hopefully don't wait till it's broken down on the side of the road and go, well.
Should have done something about that. Yeah,
exactly. I think I need oil.
Right. Yeah. Huh. That's interesting. Well, good stuff.
Yeah.
I hope that's helpful to people out there. I think, yeah, like it's never too soon to, you know, go see somebody, right? You just lessen the length that those problems have been taking place, you know, at that point.
Yeah. And it's really, I mean, easy for me to say, right, but it's really not, you are just talking to someone for an hour. And if it's awful, if your experience of going to counseling is awful, number one, there's other counselors out there, right? We're not all the right fit for everyone. And number two, even if it's awful, your investment at that point is still, you've spent an hour in a conversation with someone. And to think that on the flip side, what you could gain is a whole new service, a whole new support that could help you with something that we assume you've already been thinking about. It just seems like the cost is low compared to the benefit.
Yeah, totally. Totally. Well said. All right. So to sort of end out these podcasts, I like to ask a couple questions. So the first one is, what is the most interesting or strangest job that you have ever had?
It's a hard one to answer. I worked for a day. This is probably the strangest job, and I only worked there a day, so it's hard for me to claim it as a job. But it was so strange the first day. I worked for a day for a flood, fire, disaster cleanup company. And my plan was to work there for an entire summer. I think it was between maybe my freshman and sophomore year of college. And day one, because I wasn't authorized to do anything else yet, I got given the job of, I went through piles and piles of product from a grocery store that had been closed down and condemned. And I went through the product to see what had been too destroyed by like rat feces and things like that and what could be salvaged. So that was my day, was spent going through that. At that same part, if that wasn't bad enough, what I got to hear was all the guys who were authorized, what I would be doing later that summer if I stayed, was all of the disgusting, awful things that they were getting to do, which included handling way too much human waste for my liking, as well as just some extremely graphic situations that, so literally at the end of the day, I remember, I didn't quit on the spot, but I remember going and saying to my parents, like, I cannot do this. I will do anything else. I will literally do anything else. I cannot do this. And calling up the next day and just being done. It took me a day. And I felt, it was one of these interesting moments where I felt really guilty because I didn't like to be a quitter. But I remember having the clear realization in that day, like, no, I can't do this. I can do what I'm doing, but I don't, whatever these guys have that allows them to come back with smiles on their faces from doing what they told me they were doing, I didn't have that. That wasn't in me. So,
well, that's good to know about yourself, right?
It was clear confirmation that my future was not in the flood, fire, catastrophe, restoration, cleanup industry.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Wow.
It was a treat.
Okay. Well, that's interesting. This is like so my favorite part of the whole podcast is hearing these stories. It's amazing. Okay. So to end out, what advice would you give to maybe a younger person in college kind of going through their MA or whatever, as far as bringing sort of their faith, the kingdom, into, you know, what you do and to a counseling practice?
You know, I would say don't be embarrassed or afraid to be confident that your faith is does fit with this idea of mental health and psychology. And I don't mean that from a, if faith didn't fit it, then faith has got to go, right? I want to encourage that faith, our faith, which stands first and foremost, the truths that we see in psychology are not in opposition to it. And so I know I felt tempted at times, and I'm sure other people going through this process, whether it's in a master's program or in those early years of working, to almost be apologetic or distance themselves from the influences of their faith in either the classroom or the work that they're doing. And I think ultimately that was that's a miss. And I know it can be scary because it's not exactly probably encouraged. And but the integration of your faith into this work, I think makes it even more powerful. I mean, God is certainly real in helping people find healing. God was doing that work long before counselors ever came along, and seeing how you're joining him in that work, and not being embarrassed of it, not being afraid of it, not feeling like you have to corner yourself in a Christian counseling market. There are some people who are called to be in a Christian counseling market exclusively, but for young people, if they're finding it's because they think that's the only place they can practice freely, I would challenge that. So I don't know if that's, I think that's advice.
No, that's super helpful. I love that. I think that's important to say. So thanks so much again for making time, Matt.
Yeah.
It's been awesome.
Thanks for all the good questions.
Hey, heck yeah. You know, I try.
Yeah. So. You do. Thanks, yep.
Well, I hoped you enjoyed hearing from Matt. I really do hope at the same time that this podcast or this episode really sort of demystified a little bit of counseling and just what it's for and what it's about. I really do feel like the stigma is very detrimental in that, you know, at times we all need sort of this checkup and we need to, you know, make sure that we're talking to somebody and just processing. It's really important. So I really hope that Matt's story kind of did something like that for you. I'd love to hear what you think. I also, if you have people or genres of jobs that you'd love to hear about, hit me up. I'd love to know, and I'll track down some people. And it's just a lot of fun interviewing people from all sorts of different backgrounds and doing different things. And so, yeah, please get out there. Tell other people about Theology of Hustle. It's all word of mouth. So get out there and let people know. And until next time, get out there and hustle.